Ronaldinho to Messi. Will he get that first goal for Barcelona? Remember the name, Lionel Messi. At the age of 17, scores his first goal for Barcelona. Back to Mbappe! What a great day it's been for him!
Oh, spectacular, Thiago!
Haaland, look, very accomplished player himself, and Haaland
in behind goes for goal! Oh, what a start to his Dortmund career! One chance, one goal!
Hello and welcome back to the European Football Show. I'm Gavin Miller and I'm joined by two European football experts, at least in my eyes. So tonight I've got Andrew Miller from La Liga Lowdown, and I'm also joined by Byron Hutchison, who is the social media manager for the Bundesliga and the founder of Football From Afar. So gents, how are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad, Gav. How are you?
Yep, all good, mate. What about yourself, Byron?
I'm good, mate. Thank you.
Good, I'm glad to hear it. So I guess I thought I'd start off with something a little bit nice and easy. Recently in the Pure Football group chat, we've had a lot of chat about food, probably more chat about food than we have football. What I want to know from the both of you, what is the best food that you've had at any game of football? Andrew, I'll come to you first.
To be honest, I'm actually not really a big eater when it comes to sport. Probably the fast food you get at MLS games generally seems to be a pretty good quality. Talking of Orlando City specifically in this, I guess in Australia as well, the kind of famous meat pie is the sort of main staple at their sporting events, which is significantly better than the shit you get at football games here. Special apology to the entire county of Kilmarnock, but hey-ho. But yeah, to be honest, I don't really tend to eat. I usually have something to eat before I go to a game, and I don't tend to eat well in there, so I'm probably not the best kind of reference on that one.
Well, that's nice and disappointing, mate. So, and also, you've missed out the St. Johnston's steak and chorizo pie, which is the absolute one as well. So you're missing out if you've not tried that. Byron, what about yourself?
I hate to be a disappointment, but I'm similar to Andrew in that I don't tend to eat
for God's sake.
Just because, I mean, it's for the most part, it's 10 minutes of queuing, right? And I'm there to watch a game. Also, obviously, they'll understand that for some people, the experience of going to the football is what it's all about. And part of that's having some of the food. So I do have an answer for you. At Betis last year, I enjoyed some sunflower seeds. Not quite a full snack, but a full meal, but a decent snack. So that was quite nice, part of the experience. But at Dortmund, I was fortunate enough one time to have some more expensive tickets and had access to the lounge, and they served up some very nice artisanal currywurst.
Oh wow!
I'm not really a big currywurst guy, to be honest, but they had that kind of like street food vibe going. You know the Arches in Glasgow, actually, how they have that big food thing. It was that kind of vibe
platform,
of like,
yeah,
platform. That's it. I couldn't remember the name. Not been in Glasgow for like 2 years now, but that. That was the kind of vibe of the currywurst they were serving. It was very good.
Nice.
So I would go for that.
Shout out to Platform. If anyone's not been there, it's absolute stunning food in there. If you can get there, I guess that's the next thing. But well, I guess the currywurst definitely up there. I'll give credit to that, and also props for the sunflower seeds. I don't think I would associate that with going to a game of football, but fair play.
I think Andrew
can do the traditional Spanish thing and leave a little pile of sunflower seed shells at your feet, crunching all the way through
the guy beside me was munching sunflower seeds and smoking a joint. So
yeah, that's a pretty regular staple at Spanish games. That's just the smell of weed in the air.
Love that. Absolutely excellent behaviour in Betis. Okay, so let's get back to the actual football itself, and most leagues have played between sort of 5 to 10 matches in mainland Europe. And I want to know from both of you, who are two players that have impressed you so far and why? And Byron, I'll come to you first.
Sure, I found it quite hard to narrow down to just two, but I've got there in the end. I think the first one would be Jonas Hoffmann from Borussia Mönchengladbach. He's really stood out so far this season in a team that I think when most people think of Gladbach, they probably think of Plea and Thuram and maybe Neuhaus after that pass now against Inter. But Hoffmann was the guy on the end of that pass. He scored 4 goals, got 4 assists in 8 games in all competitions. He got his first call-up for the Germany squad as well at 28 years old. And he's really kicked on. I think he's shown that he's realizing the promise I think a lot of people had for him when he was a young player at Borussia Dortmund quite a while ago now. But him coming on and playing really well is a really nice and big addition for Gladbach. It really rounds out their attack very nicely, I think. Between Thuram, Plea, Stindl and Hoffman, they have a sort of four-pronged thing going on now that's really hard for any team in the league to contend with. And if he can keep that up over the course of the season, he'll be a really key player for them and a really nice, not addition, but you know, it's almost like an addition in terms of being at that level. And then the second one is Sasha Kalajic at VfB Stuttgart. Really interesting player who I wasn't actually aware of before the start of the season. He's 23 years old, Austrian striker who's 6'7". Which when I saw that, I was like, I need to watch the first game of the season just to see. And he came on and scored. So he's now scored 3 goals and got 2 assists in 363 minutes for a newly promoted side. So he's done really well. The whole Stuttgart team are really interesting, and I would encourage anyone to watch them play. They're playing Schalke this weekend, actually. So if you get the chance, tune into Stuttgart. They're a really interesting, fun attacking team with a lot of good young players. But outside of just like his goal scoring record and that, he's got a really good touch. He's a really clever player, good flick-ons, good movement. He's not the most athletic, but he still has that, I guess, the sort of Giroud-esque qualities in that he's just comfortable on the ball. He's quite clever. He's a really fun watch, and the fact that he's 6'7" makes it a bit of a interesting sort of freak show to watch as well. And then the last one I would say is probably just as an additional shout out would be Andre Kramaric. Scored 6 goals in 3 games. Missed his last 2 games because he got COVID, I think. But if you factor in the last game of last season as well, where he scored 4 against Dortmund, he scored 10 goals in his last 4 games. So probably him as well.
Yeah, some really interesting players there. And I think just to go back to first of all, that pass by Neuhaus, I think that's like, you know, assist pass heaven. Like, there's literally, it's almost like something you would want to watch. Like, it's like assist porn, I'm trying to think of. It's just, it was incredible. And it's the sort of thing that you could just watch on loop. But I also love the fact that you tend to find with bigger national teams, people at that certain age, if they're not already capped, they tend to get overlooked. Do you think in Germany that they're a little bit more open to that? Or is it just sort of just the way he's playing, it's hard to leave them out?
I think it was timing, really. Probably, or maybe not, but I think you probably have heard about the new wave of German players that they're trying to bring into the team, and they're omitting people like Müller and things like that, and sort of trying to transition to a new generation. He's obviously 28, so he's not quite part of that, but because there are spaces and he's in form and playing really well, I think it's more a case of timing. More than anything.
Okay, that's fair enough. But you love to see it, and also a huge fan of any football player that's 6'7". I think that's just incredible to be that tall and playing football. It's almost like Jan Koller. I think that's what he was like for the Czech Republic back in the day.
The thing about Kalajic as well, though, is that he's not Jan Koller was a big lump. He's a big built guy. Like, he filled out his frame. Kalajic is a big, tall, skinny guy, so it looks a bit strange, but he's a really tidy footballer, so I'd encourage watching him.
Yeah, definitely sounds like someone to keep an eye on over the course of the season. Andrew, what about you? Who's the names that you've got for us?
Yeah, I kind of found it hard to narrow down to 2, and I think I definitely agree with the Jonas Hoffman one from Bayern. I did a little bit of build-up the other night for the Mönchengladbach-Real Madrid game, and he was one of the players that we highlighted. It was quite a surprise, actually. I hadn't really heard a lot of him since he sort of played with Borussia Dortmund, and I was quite surprised to see the goals and assists that he had so far this season. I think it was like 4 and 5 and 7 games or something like that. So he's been obviously a nice surprise. For me, kind of the main one that pops out is probably Mikel Merino. I think, again, back to kind of what Byron said, you know, we've been kind of spoiled this season with a lot of younger players coming through and establishing themselves in their kind of respective first teams, but for me, Merino's probably the name that kind of springs to mind as being a real standout. Most fans, I suppose, probably know him as being a sort of bit part player a few years ago at Borussia Dortmund, and then he was kind of in and out the team at Newcastle under Rafa Benitez, but got a move to Real Sociedad a couple of seasons ago, 2 seasons ago now, and he's been fantastic ever since. Their coach, Imanol Kenna, likes to rotate a lot, but Marino seems to be that sort of centrepiece of their squad now. They rotate kind of David Silva, Ander Guevara, Martin Zubimendi. I'm trying to think who else they have. They have a sort of four or five rotation of central midfielders, but Marino seems to be that kind of anchor now. He's played the most midfield minutes of anyone. Works really hard off the ball. His kind of defensive position is excellent. It recovers pretty well, which is a bonus in this team because I think their centre-backs are generally really good on the ball. So they kind of naturally do roam a little bit further up the pitch, and he's one of the players that kind of, I guess, gives them that sort of cushion, that sort of extra defensive padding to do so. He was one of the kind of top three players in the league last season in tackles won. He's in the top 10 again this season. His progressive passing is really well. He's developed really well. It's a good size for a midfielder as well. I was actually quite surprised at how tall he was. Yep. He's about 6'2". He uses his body pretty well in the air as well. He has been an aerial threat, particularly at set pieces. The only thing I would kind of like to see him improve on a little bit is his aggression. He seems to give away quite a lot of fouls. I guess that kind of comes with the territory of being a sort of defensive ball winner on such a fast-paced team. To be honest, I could have kind of mentioned anyone in that team, to be honest. Real Sociedad have been probably one of the better teams in Europe this season. They've got, obviously, Mikel Arsenal's grown into a really phenomenal player and is now the captain. He's still only 23 years old. Christian Porto came on from a really great season last year. He's been a really big sort of factor in them being such a likeable and fun team. And they're just a good, fun team. They have a lot of academy players, which I always like. A lot of their sort of rotation, Ander Barrenechea, we've sort of mentioned in a few podcasts before. Zubimendi, who I mentioned earlier on, these are all Real Sociedad sort of academy youth players. So really, yeah, I could have sort of picked anyone from that team, but I think Mikel Merino should be the standout. He's been one of the best players in the league, and I guess that's been kind of recognised with him being in the Spain team.
Yeah, I think with Merino, I remember him at Newcastle, well, obviously being a Newcastle fan. I was absolutely distraught when he was pretty much just shunted out the door. I think even when he was playing for Newcastle, he was still one of the better players in the team, and that team was horrendous. You know, really not good to watch, but Marino always stood out to me, and I was just so surprised that they moved on from him so quickly. I felt like there was definitely a player in there, and I think, you know, it's great that he's now getting the recognition at international level, and I've got a feeling that there's probably still another move in him yet, I'm not sure to as of who, but I do think there'll be teams looking at him and thinking that's the sort of midfielder that you know will benefit. I think players that can play two ways, you know, box to box, are very valuable. And Marino is, you know, good enough defensively and good enough in the final third. So I wouldn't be surprised if he's targeted in the summer window.
Yeah, that's it. And he's still only 24 years old, so there's probably a lot of growing still to do. As you say, he's good. He's good defensively. He's good getting forward. He's probably not even close to hitting his peak yet. So, you know, you could easily see him being, you know, a Manchester United, a Chelsea, a Man City absolutely. Target. Potentially even the likes of sort of Real Madrid and Barcelona. Yeah. You know, Real Madrid are really kind of light when it comes to a more defensive midfielder. You know, they suffer a lot with Casemiro out the team, and they're very different players. But I guess he adds another kind of defensive element that a team like that could look at. So I'd probably agree that he has really started to thrive under Imanol and Real Sociedad, and I guess that, you know, really puts him in the shop window, particularly for or particularly with them now playing in Europe as well. You know, they're playing against Napoli in 15 minutes time from when we're recording. So
yeah.
You know, he's now on the European stage as well. So it's hard to imagine him being at a team, unfortunately being at a team like this whole career. They are a really, really good team. They've got great fans, they've got a great stadium, they're a really good academy, really sort of nice, sort of well-liked, supported team. But you know, as we all know, it's hard for slightly smaller teams to keep hold of their best players.
Absolutely. Totally agree, mate. Totally agree. Interesting player to watch. Who was your next pick?
So the other one I'm going with is Sergio Canales, both because of how well he's played in the opening rounds of the season and because I support Real Betis. So I'm just sort of happy that they're finally starting to look like a functional football team again. Manuel Pellegrini's come in and done a pretty good job. But, you know, he had a really tough time last season under Ruby, which was a kind of common theme across the entire playing squad. But generally, he just looked kind of frustrated and completely shot of confidence. You know, he was playing a lot of the time in an unfamiliar role, kind of deeper in that midfield.
Yeah.
He's not really defensively sound enough to be put into that. And he just wasn't used to it. The way that team were playing, they sort of ball hogged. It was pretty stagnant. They struggled to create anything, and it really didn't give him much in the way of kind of space to play in. But this season, he's back in a kind of more creative role. Pellegrini's moved Joaquin back over to the right-hand side, so that means Canales is on the left flank. Plays as a kind of, not quite a winger, not quite a wide player, more of a sort of, I guess, a sort of left attacking midfielder. He roams through the middle quite a lot, but that's a pretty good place for him to be, because they obviously have Alex Moreno at left wing back. He roams very, very far forward, so it kind of means that he can take up that space ahead of Canales, and it gives him the opportunity to drift in. So yeah, he's been a really good player this season. He's leading the league in goal creation actions so far, seeing a lot more of the ball in key areas. He's a lot of really good key passes. He's playing with a confidence again, which I think is one of the biggest things for him. He seems to be a player that, you know, if his confidence gets low, his performances really, really struggle. And he set up the last-minute winner against Alaves in match day one, which is really good, and scored an absolutely stunning goal against Valencia a few weeks ago, where he sort of, it's hard to kind of explain, he sort of chipped it past Daniel Vaz of Valencia with his left foot and then volleyed it with his right. I can try and find the video and post it on Twitter later on tonight for anyone that wants to go and look at it, but absolute football and filth. He just looks happy, to be honest. He played in both of Spain's Nations League games a couple of weeks ago, and he's back to having a kind of recognised and established role within pretty decent attacking system. So that's exactly kind of what he does best and what he needs. So he's my other player, and obviously being a supporter of that team, I've got a little bit of bias, but he's been brilliant this season so far.
I love that. I think with Canales, you can absolutely see it in his data that he didn't like playing in a deeper role, or he wasn't suited to it. His attacking and creative output is absolutely outstanding. His expected assists, his completions, his dribbles, all these things look really good in comparison to the rest of the league, but you can see his defensive performance is absolutely lackluster. I think for his defensive duels, whilst we're on the hot topic of stats, he was in the 0.01 percentile. So he was literally one of the worst when it comes to actually making defensive actions. So
yeah, and to be fair, like it wouldn't,
it's not his game
been,
though, is it?
No, not at all, and it probably wouldn't have been as bad with a really, really strong defence behind him. You know, Betis were a complete shambles last season, pretty much front to back, and the defence was one of the worst in the entire league, so I think that probably played into it as well, that he couldn't, there was nowhere for him to hide. If he made a mistake, it was probably going to result in a goal, and I think that obviously affects a player's confidence, as I said, a lot more.
Yeah, absolutely. Interesting pick again, mate. Interesting pick. I'm going to give you two quick fire ones from myself, and I'll be interested to hear any thoughts that you guys might have on these players. So sticking with Newcastle rejects, Florian Thauvin, who you may know from that excellent time where he turned up in a tuxedo for a game, which is absolutely outstanding pattern. To wear a tuxedo on the way into a game, especially for Newcastle of all teams. But Thauvin has really progressed incredibly well since going back to Marseille, back playing in France. He's a key component in Andre Villas-Boas' team. He's someone that I think when he came to England, you could almost tell from the offset that he just wasn't the right type of player to adapt to British football. Doesn't particularly like the rough and tumble, the physical challenges, draws quite a lot of fouls as a player with his quick feet, but you just knew that it wasn't going to work. I think that just reminds me of, was it Alan Pardew's obsession with French players? Which was incredible. Thauvin is really contributing to Marseille and their turnaround. I think that he's just the sort of player that you like to watch. You know, he likes to get at people, likes to cut in, likes to try and make things happen. Marseille, back in the Champions League, which is great. Unfortunately, got absolutely smashed off Man City, but that's no disrespect when you obviously compare the sizes of the teams. But I just like to see him doing well, and I think I've also got a sort of spot for him just for not even just the tuxedo, but I always remember him being excellent in Football Manager like 4 years ago. So a lot of love for Florian there. Any of you guys got any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I would totally agree. I haven't seen a lot of them. I watched the PSG Royal Rumble a few weeks ago, and I think, if I'm not wrong, he scored the winning goal for that.
Yep,
so that was
right.
Always good to see. It's always nice to see PSG lose a game.
Couldn't agree any more with that. Yeah, he's just a top lad. Tuxedo patter, that's what you're after.
I think as well, like, it's a wee bit interesting that obviously he was at Newcastle, but he didn't really play a lot, did he? And like,
no.
I think teams are quite quick to write off signings, and I mean, obviously we're not privy to what goes on behind the scenes, and maybe things just didn't work out personally or whatever. But when you consider, like, compare him with someone like Miguel Almirón, who also is taking time to settle, but has been given game time and been allowed to adapt to a new style of football, a new lifestyle, like that kind of thing. Sometimes I think teams are quite quick to sort of cash in or cut their losses on a signing when maybe they could have hung on for a little while longer and it might have worked out. But
yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. I think with Thauvin specifically, I think when you scout him, you know the way that he's going to play, you can see what his frame's like. You have to have your expectations ready that there's going to be an adjustment period coming to England, where it's a little bit more physical than the French league. And I think you know when he went back to Marseille, I think three seasons in a row he had over double digit goals returned, so you can't ask for much more from a winger. So I think that's a really, really fair shout there, Byron. My next shout is someone, again sticking with Ligue 1, is Carol Toko Akambi, who you might know from his time in Spain, Andrew.
Yeah, with Villarreal. A Villarreal player.
Yep. So Toko Akambi has been absolutely outstanding for Lyon this season. He's playing pretty much anywhere, you know, from left wing, right wing, centre forward, and I think he's an absolute nuisance. He's just someone I wouldn't say he's lightning quick, but I think he's deceptionally quick, and he's the sort of player that I think gets into really smart spaces. He's able to drop into the half spaces. He's able to stretch, you know, centre backs by pulling into wider areas, creating space for other players. And I think, you know, he's just someone that I'm not 100% sure why it didn't particularly work out from in Spain, and maybe you'll be able to give us a little bit more on that, Andrew. But his performance so far for Lyon's been absolutely outstanding. He's one of the best strikers in front of goal in Ligue 1. He's his XG shot is the best in Ligue 1, or one of the best in Ligue 1, sorry. Obviously, when you take into consideration he's up against people like Mbappe, that makes it a lot more difficult. But you know, he's doing really well, and I like players that are versatile, and I like players that can offer you a different sort of threat. And also, I think sometimes in games, you can be quick to substitute a player when actually the right thing might be to change the player's role within the game. And I think Toko Akambi has absolutely given Lyon that that versatility in game. Any thoughts on him, Andrew?
Yeah, I totally agree. I tweeted a couple of times the other night when they were playing against Monaco. He scored two. I think it was his second brace in two or three games. And you know, as you say, he was a really, really top player. He played right across that front line. I do agree that the pace is probably a little bit kind of underrated, but he is, you know, he is lightning quick when he gets going. Lyon were playing a lot of through balls, and he was just being able to run straight through the kind of Monaco back line, and I think that's where he didn't quite get the same delivery when he was at Villarreal. I think that was one of the problems they had. To be honest, the reason they let him go, I would say, was probably more a consequence of who else was in the team. They had Gerard Moreno really sort of nailed down that top spot up centre forward. On the left wing, they had a lot of good options, Javi Ontiveros. They tried to play him on the right-hand side a few times, but they also have Samuel Chukwueze, who's a really, really good young African player that's coming through. Probably a lot of sort of FIFA and Football Manager players will know him. He's a sort of prototypical wonder kid. He's got a lot of pace, he's got a lot of trickery, he can score, he can create, he's really sort of technically brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
To be fair to him, you know, he did pretty well at Villarreal. I'm not 100% certain on his goal numbers, but he had a relatively decent goal return. I think stylistically, he wasn't quite what Javi Calleja wanted. And joke's on him because he got sacked, obviously, at the end of the season. So, but yeah, like, it's good to see him playing for Lyon, playing really well. He's not old. I think he's only still, you know, 27 or 28. So it's nice to see him finally sort of nail down a place in a team like Lyon. And they got a bargain, you know, they didn't pay a lot of money for him. It was it was somewhere between sort of 12 or 13 million euros. Yeah. So it's pretty good value for a player that can give, as you say, you know, sort of that versatility alongside, you know, some of the other forwards that Lyon have.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And I think Lyon, I'm going to talk about them a little bit later on. I'm having a bit of a French focus tonight, but it's interesting to see how Lyon are developing as a team. And I think it's really interesting as well, and I'm sort of spoiler alert, but interesting how Ekambi coming in and getting settled. Obviously, their season was curtailed last year, but it seems to have made Moussa Dembele a little bit redundant just now for Lyon, which is interesting. But we'll get to that later. But moving from, I guess, our hot list to a bit of the hot seat, I asked both you guys a question in the briefing. I'm not sure if either of you have actually looked this up or not, but do you know how many managers in 2020 have been sacked alone across the top five leagues? So England, France, Germany, Spain, Italy.
Are you talking about 2020 as a year or 2020?
Yeah, sorry, 2020 as a year. Yeah, sorry, I should have.
Yeah, that was my... So I've misunderstood the question, but I'll give it a guess anyway. I'm going to say 7.
Ooh.
I mean, Espanyol went through about 15 managers last season alone. So 2020 as a full calendar year, I'm going to say about 40 to 50.
Oh, not quite as high. We're actually on 27 managers have been sacked in 10 months of a
That's
year.
That's actually not too bad, to be fair.
7 sounds would have mental.
Yeah.
I don't know why. I thought maybe there was some... Maybe people were being a bit more... a bit nicer just because of COVID and that, you know, not wanting to sack people when there's weird circumstances, but guess not.
Yeah, I think when you take COVID into consideration, it probably benefited some managers and I guess some others not so much. I think, interestingly enough, most of the managers sackings actually did come in Spain, and I'm not sure. Yeah. I think that's Spain and Italy have got quite a cutthroat culture when it comes to managers, don't they? They're a little bit quicker to pull the trigger.
Yeah, they can be. I mean, as I say, Espanyol went through, I'm pretty certain it was 4 managers last season. Barcelona went through, 2? Ernesto Valverde and Kiki Setién. Javi Calleja got fired. Albert Saladas got fired from Valencia. Ruby obviously got fired from Betis, which was a good one. Quite a few in and out. I'm trying to think of who else. David Wagner got fired a couple of weeks ago, didn't he, from Schalke? I'm trying to think of who else there is. But yeah, the sort of Spanish teams, there's just no fucking about at all. It's do your job or you're gone, really.
Absolutely excellent behaviour, to be honest. I'm a huge fan of that. so I guess, just quickly on that, whilst I'm talking about excellent behaviour, huge shout out to Palermo 2016 when they went through, I think it was 9 managers and went through 1 manager 3 times. That is absolutely the pattern that you're living for, right? Huge fan of that. So yeah, I guess the purpose of this little section was just to talk about what managers do we think might be in a bit of trouble based on some early season performances. And obviously, you know, you did mention there David Wagner lost his job. I think there's been a couple in Germany as well that have lost their job. So any thoughts on anyone that could be in a bit of trouble? Andrew, I'll come to you first, mate.
I'm just trying to think in Spain. I think Gaisca Garitano at Athletic Clubs probably should be under more pressure than he probably is. He probably has been under some pressure for a little while. You know, they've not been a particularly good team for the last couple of seasons, and I get that he's working under probably the most sort of difficult and strict transfer structure probably in all of football with the Basque only policy. But even then, you know, they've got a much better squad than the results would suggest. Fans are frustrated, the players are frustrated, the games are slow, unattractive. Probably most importantly, obviously, they're dropping points where they really shouldn't be. And he's a little bit too stuck in his ways for my liking. He seems to prefer playing a very defensive setup. They've only scored 3 or 4 goals in the first 6 games this season, which is the lowest in the league by quite a bit. And they drew with Eibar, who are struggling. They lost to Alaves earlier on. They lost to newly promoted Cadiz. And they've got a pretty tough run of games over the next few weeks. I'll need to have a look at the actual fixtures, but I know for a fact they've got Sevilla and Betis. They have Getafe. They've got a pretty tough December. They've got Real Sociedad coming up in December as well, which is a team I've spoken about. And it's kind of hard to see where they're going to potentially turn it around. It kind of just feels like it's just gone stale, and both parties could do with a fresh start. You know, they can't go out and buy in a load of new players to freshen up the squad, so it kind of feels like a change of coach is the only real option for them to have any hope of turning it around before it's too late.
Yeah, I think obviously the Basque constraints are definitely an issue for I guess any manager, but yeah, that'll definitely be one to keep an eye on.
Yeah, I mean the main issue they have, I guess, now with player recruitment is that they've always been able to steal the best players from the likes of Real Sociedad, but you know, they've developed into a far better team now, so the likelihood of them being able to sort of convince their best players to make the switch is a lot tougher. And essentially, you know, if they don't have the Real Sociedad pool to recruit in, that's got 75% of their, you know, potential transfer targets out the window straight away. So yeah, it feels like getting rid of him and getting a new coach in really is the only option for me now.
Yeah, that's definitely an interesting one. I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but luckily I've got a Scots abroad expert on my podcast right now. What's the name of the kid again from Bilbao that's got the
Ewan Rain? Yeah, you can go for the Spanish pronunciation of his surname, Andrew.
I'm good, thanks.
I just as a quick take, do you think he's got any chance of being in around the first team?
I would say probably not this season. Not sure if Andrew disagrees. I think he was in the reserve side last season and got an injury. So I think he'll probably be in the reserves again this year. But he was obviously training with them in the preseason. And I guess if he performs really well, he might be in line for getting moved up or getting a bit of time with the first team. But I don't think he'd be starting.
Yeah, okay. That's fair. Okay. Andrew, is there anyone else that you thought of, or was that your shout for the hot seat?
Not off the top of my head, no. I think he's the sort of main one. There are a couple of managers that kind of need to get their shit together. I think Zinedine Zidane probably should be under a little bit of pressure now. They've gone last season from being, I think they were the best defensive team in all of Europe. I'll need to double check that. That may have been a lot of shit, but they were a brilliant team last season. Obviously, they won the league. They did relatively well in the Champions League. They sort of humiliated Barcelona, and they just haven't been anywhere near as good this season. They've got pretty much the exact same team. They didn't make any signings. They brought back Martin Odegaard from a loan, but that's really the only difference they've got in the entire team. And they just seem to be struggling a lot to kind of create anything. And defensively, as I say, they've not been anywhere near as good. And you know, I think Zidane, I don't want to say he's a bad coach, but I think he's benefited from being a Real Madrid coach and not coaching a slightly smaller, poorer side, we'll say that. But I think he probably should be under a little bit of pressure now. They're certainly not in sort of dire straits. You know, they're not going to get relegated or anything like that, but they definitely need something, some kind of spark.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Byron, what about you? Is there any managers in particular that you think need to turn things around pretty quickly?
Yeah, probably. I mean, the bottom three in the Bundesliga are all terrible at the minute. Everyone else is kind of where they should be. The except for Stuttgart, who I'd say are overachieving. But Manuel Baum, who came in at Schalke to replace David Wagner, has picked up a point in three games. So maybe a bit harsh to say he's on the hot seat, but like he really needs to try and turn it around, because Schalke being 17th in the league without a win is not good for any club that size. There's a lot going on there in the background. They're a bit of a mess in general, so you can't really pin anything on him, but I would think he would have to show signs of turning it around. They just got beat 3-0 in the River Derby as well, so yeah, he'd have to show some signs. As well as that, Marcus Gisdol at FC Köln, they're really struggling as well. They've drawn two, I think, lost three. They're yet to win. They're 16th in the league, and they're playing Bayern at the weekend. He's been in the manager's position at Cologne for a while, so he's one that I would think, yeah, he needs to improve quite quickly. And then the last one is, I think someone mentioned earlier, Bjørn Larsson was replaced at Mainz. this season as well by Jan Lichter, who was his assistant coach. I wouldn't be too harsh on Jan Lichter, but they're bottom of the league, lost five games. Mm. So, I mean, they're the three really obvious ones. And then the one that's the one that I would say needs to turn it around the most is probably Bruno Labbadia at Hertha Berlin. I think we've talked about it on the podcast before. They have their sort of big city project that started with Jurgen Klinsmann coming in and sort of doing Jurgen Klinsmann things and then disappearing. But they made quite a few signings in the summer. Yeah. They spent about 33 million euros, which isn't a huge amount in the grand scheme of football, but given the circumstances of 2020, it's quite significant. And on top of that, they signed like Lucas Tussar in January as well, spent quite a bit of money in January. And they have a pretty good team. When you look through their squad, like there's a lot of interesting, exciting players. But they've won one game this season. They lost their first four games. They're really struggling, and I think he has to turn it around because they really don't have too many excuses. Like I say, they have good players between Piontek, Cunha, Tussar, Luca Bacchio. They brought in Matteo Guendouzi on loan. They have a good squad, and when you look through it, they really should be a top 10 side. They obviously have ambitions of playing in the Champions League and things like that, but when I look at their squad, they shouldn't be down in 15th struggling to pick up points every single week.
Yeah, I think that's pretty fair. Hertha Berlin were the team that was looking, you know, I thought, you know, considering what they spent and the players they have, I think Kuna and Tussat are two excellent signings. So I think that, yeah, they definitely need to turn that around quickly. I remember back the last time we spoke that I was really positive about Andre Pirlo and how he was going to spark some sort of turnaround at Juve.
I was wondering when that was going to come up.
And was very, very foolish. or it looks that way now. And Juve are absolutely struggling in Serie A. They're sitting down in 11th, albeit there's only four games played, but they're already 7 points behind AC Milan. Their performance in terms of XG for and against as a team are not good. They've scored 7 goals and conceded 4. Their XG for is 7 goals and they should have conceded 6. So it's not looking good for them. They've drawn with Crotone and Verona, who, you know, that's just completely unacceptable when you're a team the size of Juventus. Crotone's only point this season was against Juventus in 5 games. They obviously spent really big, have got some really big names. So for my prediction of Juve to be something special this year, something needs to happen, and I might have to move on from Pirlo very quickly. Another one I thought I would give a really quick shout out was just to Niko Kovac at Monaco. Again, it's still extremely early in the season, right? But again, when you look at Monaco's underlying numbers, they're not really setting the world on fire. They obviously brought in players like Kevin Volland, who I think we spoke about before and we're quite excited about, and they've got a number of, you know, good players in that squad, but they just do not seem to be able to make it click for extended periods of time. And they're, as I mentioned, underlying numbers are not looking great after 8 games, scored 11, conceded 13, and that's pretty much what their expected goals is saying as well. So it's not even like a case where you can argue that, you know, they're just being unlucky or things will come good. It just does not look good for Monaco right now under Kovac.
The interesting thing about Monaco for me is that, like, he's not the first coach to have struggled there. They've seemed to have been in this kind of flux for a couple of years now, or ever since Jardim left, really, or was sacked for the 9th time or whatever it was. they've got good players, they've got a good squad, they recruit reasonably well. But something just doesn't seem to click. I don't know if it's even just the culture of being at Monaco, maybe, and that it feels like a bit of a mercenary club anyway, that people go there to try and as a stepping stone, essentially. I don't know if that's maybe a factor, but that's just conjecture from my part. I don't watch Monaco every week, but I do see them struggling. And then when, as you say, you look at their squad, you think, well, Ben Yedder, Volland, Gelson Martins, like, these guys should be at the top end of Ligue 1, I would say.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I actually thought Kovac was quite a strange appointment. I think considering how things panned out at Bayern, I thought that Monaco might have avoided that sort of appointment. And I think you're right to call out, there definitely seems to be some sort of culture aspect to it, because they do have some some really interesting players. It just does not seem to click for whatever reason. I think they need to almost probably look back into some of the coaches that are in France just now, like Julien Stéphane at Rennes. You would imagine that Monaco would be able to pay him whatever he wants to make that sort of move happen. So definitely one to keep an eye on. And
they're a sort of strange team. Like they, as Byron said, you know, they've gone through a few coaches. They had Robert Moreno, who was you know, Luis Enrique's assistant for a long time. He took over the Spain job while Enrique was out. His daughter was really unwell, and Moreno took over, and he was really good. And you know, they brought him on. There was a lot of excitement. They signed a lot of good players, and you know, he lasted 13-14 games, and they sacked him. It's hard to see. It's kind of hard to see like where even is it going wrong, because they have good coaches, they have good players. It's sort of, things should be clicking and they just aren't. So again, it's kind of back to what Byron said, you know, is it a culture thing? Is it the leadership? Is it, yeah, you know, what is the actual issue? Because, you know, how many coaches and players are they going to have to go through before they get back to where they were a few years ago? They were a Champions League team a few years ago, and as you say, they've just kind of dwindled ever since.
Even just like what Gavin was saying about Kovac coming in, obviously his time at Bayern wasn't great despite winning a few things and then eventually losing his job. But I think they probably recruited him on the basis of what he did at Frankfurt before that, where he was really good with decent resources, but obviously not top end, and won the Pokal and did really well there. And I suppose if you're Monaco and you look at someone like Kovac and see that he's done that, you would hope that he could maybe come in and do the same with similar resources up against a big team like PSG in Ligue 1, similar to what he would have been up against in Bayern in the Bundesliga.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's obviously not really going well for him at the moment either.
Yeah, I think that's quite a fair point. Quite a fair point there. Okay. I guess, and let's move on to our final section of tonight then, and let's look at games that we're excited about this weekend, and just any sort of things that you think people should look out for. And Byron, I'll come to you first on this one if you want to tell me something you'll be looking out for this weekend.
So there's two games in the Bundesliga I would say to watch. The first one is purely because I recommended watching Stuttgart, because they're a really interesting, exciting young team, and primarily because they're on a Friday night, so there's not a lot of football on. So if you're interested, they're playing Schalke, who are obviously struggling, and Stuttgart, I would expect, will do quite well there and will be at their sort of free-flowing best. So that's on at 8:30 tomorrow night, or possibly 7:30. I'm not sure of the time difference. But anyway, it's on tomorrow night. But the real big game at the weekend in the Bundesliga is Mönchengladbach versus RB Leipzig on Saturday evening at 6:30. Be a really interesting clash. Both teams had differing results in the Champions League in midweek, but Leipzig sit top of the table despite getting hammered off Man United, and Gladbach are sixth and doing okay, but I think probably underperforming given some of the things I talked about earlier between their players, the form of Jonas Hoffmann, etc. But it should be a really good tactical matchup as well between two of the sort of premier young tacticians in the Bundesliga, in Nagelsmann and Rosa. So I would recommend that one.
Yeah, that's definitely going to be a blockbuster. The Red Bull coach battle. I was just shocked there. I just had a quick look at Schalke. I didn't notice that they hadn't won a league game in 21 games. How the hell did David Wagner keep his job for so long?
I have no idea. I mean, it was one of those. I say I have no idea, but it's kind of what I was referring to earlier, where there was an acceptance that acceptance among some that the club's a bit of a mess, and that he wasn't fully to blame for everything that was going wrong. Obviously, when you go 21 games, I think you said there, without a win,
yeah,
then some responsibility lies with the manager. But I think overall it's more of a structural issue at Schalke, and that's why I think even having just taken over, Manuel Baum is still maybe in a bit of trouble.
Yeah. And just finally on Nagelsmann, thoughts on his outfit at the Champions League?
I mean, he's renowned almost in Germany for this kind of attempt at fashion, I would call it. Essentially, I mean, normally he tones it down. I mean, in the Champions League semi-final, he wore something a bit strange as well. And he seems to have like gone a bit mental for the bigger games. Generally, he's just dressed like a somewhat normal 30-year-old. Like, he'll wear trainers and trousers on the sideline, and people are like, oh, he's a fashion icon. And it's more like, no, he's just young. He's just not an old guy. But now he's taking it to another level with the shirts and the blazers and stuff that he's decided to whap out for Champions League nights. I don't know what he's up to there. It's maybe a bit weird, but it's a bit distracting, I think. Like, so much of the attention gets put on his clothing, like in a big Champions League night. There was a bit of a snarky reply to a reporter after the defeat against Man United, who asked, I think they asked him something along the lines of, I guess that jacket's not going to go in the lucky cupboard or whatever. And he said something like, yeah, don't worry about my clothes, or stop talking about my clothes. And I kind of thought, mate, just put on a black t-shirt then, no one will talk about it. But yeah. Anyway.
Also, who has a lucky cupboard? What sort of shite journalism is that?
I don't know. I have no idea, mate.
Andrew, what about you? What's your games of the weekend?
So I assumed Bayern would probably mention Mönchengladbach, Leipzig, but I had it down as well. I think Gladbach are coming off what really should have been a massive win against Real Madrid during the week. They collapsed at the last minute. And obviously Leipzig took a hiding from Man United. So I think both of them were probably coming in trying to get themselves back on form. Kind of mentioned both young, both popular managers. They both came from that sort of Red Bull group. Both teams really looking to take that next step domestically. You know, Leipzig have been really trying to challenge Bayern Munich the last couple of seasons, not quite there. Mönchengladbach have obviously got pretty high standards and aspirations as well, so I think that'll be a pretty good one. The main one for me though would be Osasuna Atletico Madrid, which I think is on Saturday night as well. It's one for the neutral fan, I would say. Osasuna are probably one of the best sides in Europe for a neutral fan to watch, because I kind of feel like if you watch them, you're just instantly going to become a supporter. They're such a fun side. It's a real shame they don't have their fans in the stadium, because they've got some of the best fans in Europe as well. They're incredibly well drilled, I would say. Arasate's probably done, you know, he's done such an amazing job. He's probably one of the most underrated coaches in Europe at the moment. They're still without their best player, Chimi Avila, who's down for a second ACL injury in 2 seasons, which is unfortunate, because he's such a fun, sort of stylish player. He just absolutely gives no fucks. It's all style, all flash, all action. He's just a really brilliant player to watch. But got a lot of really good players in there. Ruben Garcia, Roberto Torres, the captain's a really good player as well. Both of them have really stepped up since Avila went down. And stylistically, I think it'll be a bit of a kind of heavyweight tactical showdown. You know, Simeone's always got something up his sleeve. He loves a bit of a kind of shithousing. And as I say, Arasate, tactically, he's probably one of the best managers in the league at the moment. So I think they've both got players in the side that can really produce stuff. And I think as managers, they're both sort of aspirational. Obviously, Simeone's still trying to win the league, win the European cups, and obviously Arasate, you know, he got them up from Segunda last season. They finished in the top 15. They were a really big surprise package, and I think they'll be looking to really sort of kick on this season. So that would be the game for me. I think both teams are decent to watch. I think Atletico can have their games where they're brutal. They sit back, but I think having Suarez in there, having a proper goal scoring target man, has made them a little bit more open. Obviously, we've discussed them quite a few times in the Pure Football group chat. You kind of don't know what you're going to get with Atletico Madrid. They could come out and be 10 men behind the ball, just knocking everyone over, or they could come out sort of free-flowing. But it should be a really good game. As I say, the style of both teams should match pretty well. It should be a pretty interesting showdown.
Yeah, that'll definitely be. And I think, you know, any time that Diego Simeone is involved, there's always an opportunity for some sort of fireworks. So,
absolutely.
Big fan of that. I'm going to give you two games that I'm excited about really quickly. And the first one is Napoli Sassuolo in Italy. One, because I like saying Sassuolo. I think it's a fun word, or a fun place to say, for what that's worth. But the main reason is it's second v third. Sassuolo have scored 23 goals, or there's been 23 goals in their last 4 matches, which I think tells you a lot about how they play. So it's going to be an open game against Napoli, who are sitting second, and another team that, you know, it looks like in Italy this year we might have a different title winner potentially. I think Napoli, 4 games played, 4 wins, 14 goals, 2 conceded. I think that they're, well, Gattuso's proven a lot of people wrong. I think a lot of people questioned that appointment, considering he sort of struggled at Milan before and they sort of stagnated in the sort of mid sort of table. But he looks like he's starting to get things together now with this Napoli team, and he's the sort of manager that can really galvanise when it's the backs against the wall, and it's really interesting. And obviously they blew the transfer market wide open when they spent 70 odd million on Victor Osimhen, which was bonkers. I think I mentioned on another podcast that was the one of the strangest transfers for me based in terms of the fee that was paid. Then day later he went and scored, so that just sort of shut me up. I think that's going to be a game in Italy to definitely watch. You know, Napoli sitting in second on 12 points, one behind AC Milan, and Sassuolo sitting on 11 points in third. So interesting teams to watch. And Harvin Lozano as well, got to give him a shout out. He's an excellent player to watch, really fun. And Dominic Berardi at Sassuolo as well is sort of coming back to life, which is good, because for a while I think a lot of people had him down as the sort of next sort of European wonder kid, and he sort of just didn't fade away, just didn't really quite deliver. But he's had a good start to the season in Serie A so far.
I think that's just a cut in there. I think that's true of both Lozano and Berardi. Lozano was someone I was really excited about when he was at PSV, and I think after his first couple of seasons, everyone was really excited about him, and he's taking his time to acclimatise to Italy. But I think, I don't know if you said there, he's got 4 goals this season already. So he's doing really well, 4 goals in 4 games. So if he can keep that up and replicate the numbers he managed to achieve in the Netherlands, that would be really exciting.
Yeah, I'm really, really excited to see how he does this year. And I think that this Napoli team seems really well balanced in advanced areas. And I think they actually pulled off, whilst I slated them for the signing of Osimhen in terms of the fee, I think they made one of the smartest moves by picking up Bakayoko from Chelsea, who, another player that just for whatever reason doesn't seem to have had any sort of chance at Chelsea. And when he was at AC Milan last year on loan, he was one of their best players, and he's now on loan at Napoli doing really similar things. But I just really like this Napoli squad overall. They're exciting to watch. They've loads of good players on the ball. Fabian Ruiz, is another player that's excellent to watch. So this should be a fun game for anyone that's able to tune in to it, 5 o'clock on Sunday. And my final game is Lille versus Lyon. Lille, who tonight have drawn 2-2 with Celtic, coming back from a 2-0 deficit. They're currently sitting second in Ligue 1 and unbeaten in the league after 8 games. But what's impressed me about them is just their performance in front of goal and how tight they've got it as a back line. I think that they're a team that obviously sold Osimhen and they then brought in Jonathan David from Ghent and Buruk Yilmaz throwing back the years. It's good to see that Lille have been able to keep things going. They're a team that continually sells one of their key components. Obviously sold Nicolas Pepe to Arsenal a few years back, but they seem to be able to under Christian Galtier to just keep it going, which is really good. And I think for Lyon, who are currently sitting sixth, they've been a little bit unlucky actually, and results haven't quite gone their way. They've been a little bit wasteful in front of goal. Their XG is 21, but their actual goal scored is 14. So that would suggest that that they're not quite putting the chances away, or keepers are playing really well against them. And their expected points, so based on all the information available, actually would have them above PSG right now. So definitely an interesting team to play. And I think this could be a really exciting game on Sunday night. It's at 8 o'clock and it's live on BT Sport for anyone that's listening in the UK. So I'd highly recommend tuning into that if you can.
Yes, there's another wonder kid who kind of dwindled when you're talking about Lille and Renato Sanchez. He came on tonight against Celtic and I actually forgot that he existed until about then, I'm going to admit.
Does he still have his dreadlocks?
That's... He does. Yeah. They've got blonde tips and a sort of dreadlock ponytail he's rocking tonight, which is always impressive.
Excellent behaviour from him there. Excellent behaviour. I was worried you were going to mention Timo Weah there. I thought that's who you were going to say was the wonder kid. Not him, obviously. This will definitely be an interesting game to watch out for, and I think... the whether one of these teams can actually push PSG all the way, we'll have to wait and see. But I think the gap is closing. I don't think PSG are quite as dominant as they were before. So definitely an interesting league this year for me. And that takes us to the end of tonight's show. And for all of you that have stuck with us, thank you. Andrew, if anyone wants to follow you on social media, where's the best place to get you?
They can find me on Twitter at AndrewMillerNBA.
And Byron, similar to you, what about you?
Yeah, same. Byron Hutchison on Twitter.
Nice one. Excellent, guys. Thank you to everyone that's tuned in, and we'll be back soon.
Cheers,
Gav.